Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we're here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of the environment, food, health, policy, media, and popular attitudes about all of these areas. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between personal well-being, community well-being, what's going on in our society, and what's going on our planet, our habitat, planet Earth. I report also in other outlets, including Common Dreams, Truth Out, and in the Organic Food Association's Organic Bites. And we've been talking a lot over the last several weeks, months even, about the Green New Deal. And we're going to be talking about that topic from a very different slant on today's show. I'm delighted to welcome onto the show today an environmental psychologist, Dr. Susie Burke, who has produced a very interesting article, in fact, multiple articles, does her research and works with people on the psychological and mental health responses and implications of climate change. I came across her work because of a terrific article that she wrote with several other psychologists working with, at the time, the Australian Psychological Society. And I think this is really an under-researched and under-reported area that we need to be considering very closely. So I'm delighted to welcome to today's Connect the Dots, Dr. Susie Burke. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Allison. I'm pleased to be here.
This past week in the United States, we had a rather dramatic occurrence. Over the last couple of months, there has been a demand by young people, young adults, and even some teenagers joining with them, as well as people of other generations, that our country address the climate change crisis, which has been repeatedly either outright denied or backburnered in terms of, yeah, we admit it, but we can't do anything about it, which has now come to be called, on the one hand, hard climate denial, oh, this isn't happening and humans don't cause it, versus soft climate denial, oh, we cause it, but, you know, if we do a few tweaks here and there, we don't have to do anything about it. And with the UN's IPCC report, coming up last fall, we really were cut up short, Americans were, to realize that we have a dozen years before we're in a realm of unstoppable climate change with horrible global impacts and implications. And as a result, the young people, through a group called the Sunrise Movement, as well as one of our Congress people, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, have been calling for the declaration of a climate emergency and have also met that with the creation of a resolution that's the kind of initial proposal for what is called a Green New Deal, a comprehensive series of public programs aiming to address this that was recently co-sponsored with Senator in the United States, Ed Markey. And so this resolution came out just a few weeks back, about 3 weeks ago, and already there's a lot of drama and pushback going on in the U.S. government about this. And one of the things that happened in this past week is that a group of young supporters of the Sunrise Movement, which is a nationwide movement of young people, and they go around and kind of speak to people, and they basically went into the Senate in Washington, D.C., and into the office of the Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein, who is actually both the senior eldest woman in the Senate and in public office on a national level in the U.S., as well as being the senior senator in the U.S. So she's really the dean, the elder of all of the senators and all of the people in Congress, And they went into her office and were requesting that in upcoming votes that she support the Green New Deal, And she basically told them, you know, to kind of, I know what I'm doing, and don't you come in here and tell me. And one of the children actually said, oh, but, you know, if we don't solve this in 12 years, we're going to be facing this, you know, terrible crisis situation. And she told that child, oh, well, it won't happen in 10 years or so, don't tell me what to do, kind of thing. And it was kind of a really shocking moment, I think, for the American psyche. There are people who had trouble believing that children actually would have these concerns, and then others believing that an adult would respond in like manner. So given the divisions in our society, I think we saw responses on all sides of this particular question. So, I, you know, since you're an expert on this, I mean, you know, do children know about this? Do teenagers, do children, do they know about what's coming? And do they legitimately on their own, not being led or told what to say, feel concern about the effects of prospective climate change?
Yes, they do. Children do know about the effects of climate change and are deeply concerned about its impacts. In fact, some studies find that children actually have higher levels of concern about climate change than adults do. So a study that we looked at, which was done with 10 to 12-year-olds in the USA, found that 82% of those children had strong feelings that were elicited around climate change, that they had high levels of knowledge. Many people, like that young person was talking about with the senator, to actually believe that, you know, the world is in great trouble, and some children even believe that the world may end during their lifetime due to climate change and other global threats. So children are carrying a lot of information and knowledge about climate change, as well as carrying a lot of very strong feelings about climate change. And those feelings are, you know, feelings of fear and anxiety and distress and grief, the same feelings that, you know, many adults are carrying about it as well. But of course, children are a unique group in that they're particularly vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. They're going to be living in a climate-altered world longer than adults, and they're much less able because they're young and they don't vote yet, and their views can be dismissed, as this story illustrates, and don't have as much capacity to be able to make changes. And so to see children stepping up and talking out and joining together and getting into senators' offices and putting this issue in front of the nation is a really empowering thing that young people are doing. We're actually seeing that right across the world at the moment, with children are getting very children as well, you know, the 10 to 12 year olds, as well as the, you know, the adolescents and the young adults, getting very vocal about climate change because of those three aspects that I just talked about, that it will impact them and their lifetimes because they will be alive in a climate-altered world for much longer than the adults will be, that they are particularly vulnerable to climate change because of a whole lot of features about that, about children, that makes them more vulnerable, and we can talk about them in a moment. And also because they need to find unique ways of being able to draw attention to this problem because they're not yet the decision makers and the leaders. They're not making the laws. You know, they're not setting up the companies to, you know, produce and roll out, you know, solar power across, you know, vast tracts of America. So they're needing to find their own ways of being able to draw, you know, the world's attention to this and demand this urgent change.
You know, one thing I'm wondering is that, and maybe you don't, you know, you haven't studied this or don't know the answer to it, but if children are more concerned, you know, because they're more vulnerable in all of these different ways that you describe, is it also possible that they're less kind of accustomed to, you know, this going on without having to address it, or believing that you have to address it? Does the fact that adults have lived longer lives on the planet and kind of gone along with the various, you know, the programs and the infrastructures that have created this horrible dilemma, are they more inured to it for that reason? Or, you know, it must be really, I mean, that's one question. Are they more inured to it? And I guess the second question is, it must be very strange for children not to feel that they can, you know, as people and especially in, you know, are taught to do, trust and rely on their parents to be able to handle something and take care of them.
Mm. Well, that's, I'll just answer that or address that second comment first. What we find in the disaster literature, so there's a vast literature of the psychological and mental health effects of disasters on children, and children and women are always the most vulnerable in a natural disaster. They die in higher numbers, they're most impacted. And so we know from this literature that adults, when it comes to natural disasters, and you know these are often happening in developed countries where the infrastructure is very poor, so a disaster can be catastrophic because the buildings get destroyed more easily. You know, we know that adults are not actually particularly good at protecting children when, you know, catastrophic things happen. Children are very vulnerable, you know, in times of intergroup conflict as well, which can also be a consequence of the disruption and the displacement that follows from, you know, environmental stressors, of course, as well as following, you know, other stressors that countries, you know, have to endure as well. So one of the things that we do know is that even though that is adults' job, if you look, if you take a very broad perspective on it, adults are often not very good at protecting children. And in this instance with climate change, I think that's what children are starting to realise. Hey, you're not protecting our interests. Now, the first comment that you made was you were wondering, I think I understood you correctly, that you were wondering whether because adults have been enjoying, you know, the lovely world that, you know, an abundance of fossil fuels has enabled us to create around us, and an abundance of power, you know, fancy cars, food from anywhere in the world whenever we should so desire it. You're wondering whether that has meant that it's actually harder sometimes for adults rather than children who spent a smaller amount of time, you know, enjoying the riches of a fossil fuel fueled world, whether it's harder for the adults to take serious action on climate change, which would mean getting off, you know, coal and gas as fast as possible and making a transition to a lower zero carbon economy, a zero carbon economy. So this is sort of the language that's used as we move into a more sustainable future. So I've not looked at any research or seen any research that's actually been done on that, but I think it's a really interesting, you know, question to muse about. We do know that adults do put up a lot of resistance to change. You know, we all humans do struggle with having to change something that we're comfortable with. And it is the case that a lot of the resistance to climate change solutions is around not wanting to, you know, give up some of the luxuries, and a fear that making a change to a zero carbon economy will mean giving up some of the things that we've come to love and to depend on. And it's quite likely that from a child's perspective, when they're aware that they're going to be living in this climate-altered world, that that is completely unacceptable to them, and that that is part of what gives fuel to their enraged voices at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think as people become older and they become young adults, you know, the outrage, you know, kind of heightens. Because they are, you know, they're physically stronger and they are nearer to having to enter into this world that has failed to grapple with the problem in terms of their working in it, their participating as, you know, adult members of society. I think they're maybe understandably more outraged there. You know, let's take a step back and just inquire. Where, just so we have a context for what the children, you know, are having to cope with, what do you find when you look into adults' emotional responses. I realize that's not your special area, but I know that you have, you know, looked at the literature. And, you know, are adults worried? Are they just more kind of coping with it through denial or consumerism? Or, you know, are they actually kind of disinterested and detached from worry, at, you know, to a much greater extent than children are? You know, like, what percentage of adults are concerned or stressed by this, for example?
Well, we do know that adults do have high levels of awareness of climate change and high levels of distress about climate change as well. But we also know that there are a whole lot of, you know, psychological mechanisms that can jump into place, which are just part of being human, that can help us to minimize and, you know, turn away from our awareness of climate change as well. And if you think we've had a special look at parents and how they think about and feel about climate change in the last couple of years. And one of the things that, you know, we're very aware of in the literature is that parents have got a lot of things that compete for their attention when they're raising children. You know, they want a lot for their children. They want their children to, you know, do well at school. They want their children to have, you know, an economically beneficial sort of life. They want their children to, you know, make good friendships and cope with bullying and, you know, be, you know, eating healthily and all those sorts of things. So parents have got a lot on their plate. And we do know that climate change is one of those concerns that parents are increasingly expressing, but it is competing with a whole lot of other immediate everyday concerns. And we do know that humans are only capable of holding, you know, so many worries or, you know, things that they're worrying about in their mind at the one time. And very often worrying about what you're going to put on the table for dinner or how you're going to pay the bills at the end of the week or how your child is going to cope with a, you know, difficult situation that they've encountered at school can often, you know, sort of be in the front of the mind. And worrying about, you know, global climate change and the existential threat that it poses to, you know, the world is not something that's front of mind. We also know from the literature that it's very, very small numbers of people actually truly deny that climate change is happening and that it's a problem. So surveys that have been done in America and in the UK and in Australia all show that around 5-7% of people truly deny the existence of climate change. But that's not to say that a lot of people are able to minimise it or distract themselves, you know, with the endless distractions of modern life and not have it in the front of their minds as an urgent issue.
Well, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So when you say 5% and it's like, you know, and those people are all in the U.S. Senate, we know how that, you know, we know how that came about, you know, through money and politics and everything. So actually what you're saying there is that, it, at least in our country, and it may be true elsewhere as well, that the leaders have other economic interests that put them out of sync with the concerns of the majority of people. And because the majority of people are, you know, have other responsibilities and struggles, those are taking more of a foreground position. And so far, the wishes of the people have not been as rigorously brought to bear on, you know, on moving the dial on this particular major, huge, world-sized problem. You know, what are one of the things that really interested me in your piece was the discussion of what healthy versus unhealthy coping mechanisms look like for children that parents can help their children toward. And probably it may be true for adults as well. So, you know, is you know, what is a healthier way of coping with this that is both psychologically healthy for an individual and that's also healthy for the community and the society? Those are two separate things because the two may not necessarily be identical, but then maybe they are connected. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, okay. Well, when we talk about coping, we look at that as being something called psychological adaptation. So when we talk about climate change, there are these two responses that, you know, politically and in communities and internationally are really important, and that's climate mitigation, which is reducing the threat of climate change, you know, reducing emissions, carbon and greenhouse gas emissions. And then there's adaptation, which is adapting to the things, to the effects that are already in the system. And so psychological adaptation is a sort of a subset of adaptation. But there are many things that people do when they're psychologically adapting to climate change, which are also have a function to mitigate the climate risk as well. So I'll sort of unpack and explain that a little bit better. So when we talk about psychological adaptation, we talk about, you know, that's the job of coming to terms with climate change, being able to cope with the feelings that we have about climate change. But how we feel about climate change and how we think about climate change, which are both sort of psychological concepts, also has an impact and an influence then on what we do about climate change. And so then you can see how we're coping with climate change and how we're coming to terms with it is directly related to then what we do about climate change, which relates back to, you know, how we reduce the threat of climate change, those climate mitigation activities. So and the reason why we're particularly interested in how people are psychologically adapting, therefore, to climate change is both because of the impacts that it has on their personal well-being and their psychological and mental health, which has huge flow-on effects to how they are in the world and how they are in their families and so on and so forth. But also, it also has this impact on their capacity to deal with the challenges of climate change. And so for children, we see that as particularly critical because how children are responding to climate change will have a bearing on this critical role that they will play as the next leaders in our society, as the decision makers, as lifetime of consumers, and as citizens. So that sort of outlines the context of why we're particularly interested in this. So how are children coping with climate change as a stressor? That was your question. What are the variety of ways that they can do that, and how successful are those different techniques? So a lot of this work has been done by a Swedish environmental psychologist called Maria Ojala. And she's been studying children as young as 10, 11, 12-year-olds and young people and young adults in her research. And she's been mainly focusing on Swedish samples of children, but is starting to reach out and do some international collaborations to get some bigger samples. But if you think about the impacts for Swedish children, you know, that's largely climate change is a vicarious threat to children, you know, in a developed country like Sweden, which is the case for a lot of the children in Australia, where I am, and also the children in America, where climate change is a threat to other children around the world that they're aware of, and other adults. It's a threat to species around the world that children are aware of and are distressed about, but it's also increasingly being seen as an existential threat that threatens their very world, but perhaps their slightly future world. And of course, a lot of the results of the IPCC reports and other global reports on climate change are showing us that those future threats are coming closer and closer to us, and that's part of what's energising, you know, young people around the world to, you know, try to demand that leaders, you know, take serious action. So she looks at these three coping styles. One's called problem-focused coping, one's called emotion-focused coping, and one's called meaning-focused coping. Now, these are coping styles that have been studied in the literature for many, many decades. And she's gone back to this, you know, long-standing and excellent research and explored how they relate to how children are specifically dealing with climate change. So problem-focused coping is aimed at reducing the cause of the problem. So that would be the actions that people do to try to reduce, you know, carbon emissions, for example. And so examples of what children might be doing when they're using problem-focused coping might be, you know, looking for information about the problem, learning about it, breaking down a problem and looking at the various steps of a solution along the way and finding concrete things to do to address climate change. So that might be things like, you know, riding their bikes to school or walking to school or taking public transport rather than, you know, getting their parents to drive them. For older children, well, actually, when we look at the literature, we find that adolescents and the older young people tend to use problem-focused coping strategies more than the children, most likely because there is actually more that they can do. The children are much more dependent on the decisions that their parents make about how they do everything, and the older children, the adolescents and young people, are more able to have their own autonomy in the decisions that they make. So that's problem-focused coping. And then there's the emotion-focused coping, which is the things that we do to try to reduce our distress around a problem. So we're not trying to change a problem, we're trying to manage our distress around the problem. And so with climate change, some of the techniques that young people use when they're using emotion-focused coping is the ones that we were talking earlier in the program. It's the distraction, it's minimizing the problem, it's reassuring or telling yourself that it's, you know, it's probably not such a big problem. It's denying the problem or avoiding even thinking about it and paying any attention to it at all. So that would be an emotion-focused coping strategy that gets, you know, that we see young people using. And then the third type of coping strategy is the one that's most effective on a whole lot of measures, and it's called meaning-focused coping, and it's sort of using your ways of thinking about the problem to find a perspective that you can that can be somewhat reassuring, but also galvanize you also into action. So I'll give some examples. So it might be thinking about climate change in a historical context and noting that there's been much more attention on the problem now than there has been in the past, and taking comfort from the fact that, you know, there are millions of people all around the world who are now actively trying to do something about climate change, and that the, you know, that there's a great likelihood that, you know, this we will start to see some very strong climate policies around the world because of the depth of, you know, concern and interest that has grown, you know, enormously over the years. It also might be by a meaning-focused coping strategy might also be to have trust in other actors or agents, you know, organisations and individuals that are taking action on climate change. And so that's where you know, having climate change heroes can be, you know, a great sort of source of solace and inspiration for young people. Noticing the different organisations that are set up, finding the people in the Senate who, you know, in the American Senate who are actually, you know, fighting hard for great climate change policy and taking comfort for them. So that story that you told me earlier and the great controversy over the last week with the young people going in to, you know, pin down Dianne Feinstein and ask her to, you know, take what they were talking about seriously is a bit of a blow to this particular one. And that was what you were saying was part of the backlash of, you know, how, you know, shocking and devastating it can be when young people do, you know, seek for the support from people who are in a position of power and get rebuffed. So, you know, regrouping and, you know,
well, they could
looking
take comfort,
for
example, Dr. Burke, from that to say people all over the nation have seen their visit to her office and they've seen the conversation. So even though they, I mean, I would reframe it this way. So even though, you know, they had it was a shocking experience to see, you know, where the senator was in terms of trying to represent them and, you know, dismissing the need for it to happen in a timely way, even though that was very distressing. It
yes.
also revealed something to all the adults as well as other young people, you know, throughout the country who might have just been willing to coast along and not get involved themselves,
yes.
even though we know that 81% of Americans would like this to happen, you know, would like our country to address this,
yes.
you know, so... In other words, they're putting themselves on the line, and having that experience may have woken, you know, hundreds of thousands of other people potentially, who will now.
Yes, that's right.
Know.
And yes, and I would also expect that what would have happened would have been a great outpouring of adults all over America saying, "Kids, we support, you know, what you're talking about, and we believe you, and we're trying to." You know, make these changes as well, and you know that would also generate this feeling of, you know, optimism and hopefulness that even though, right at this moment in time, some of the influential leaders aren't on the right page, there are hundreds and thousands of people all around them who support their views, and so that that would be another example of the sort of a coping strategy, being able to pay attention to that and think about that and not be crushed by, you know, that experience. And so anyway, you were asking also what's the, you know, how are these different coping strategies related to, you know, well-being and, you know, action and things like that. And what Maria Ojala has found in her research is that the meaning-focused coping one is related with high levels of environmental engagement and high levels of environmental efficacy, which means a belief that you can do something and you can make a difference. And that's a very important concept in for adults and for young people, is this sense of efficacy, having a belief that the things that you do in the world actually will make a difference. And when we don't have a sense of efficacy, either for ourselves or, you know, for the groups that we belong in, then there's a risk then of feeling, you know, helpless and hopeless and depressed. So that's a very good outcome. Children that use meaning-focused coping tend to have higher life satisfaction and purpose and optimism, and they also tend to have higher well-being despite their serious concerns about climate change. But they do, but children who use the de-emphasizing the seriousness of climate change, that's a way of just being able to deal with the distressing emotions when they think about climate change through using distraction and minimization and denial and things like that, they tend to, as you'd expect, have lower levels of, you know, environmental engagement, do fewer things that are pro-environmental, but they've also got lower levels of negative feelings because, you know, they're using a strategy to help themselves to have, you know, more positive feelings. And the children that use the problem-focused coping strategies, which would be the ones that are, you know, out there busily, you know, being involved in projects and personal actions to try to reduce their own carbon footprint and the carbon footprint of, you know, the communities around them. Of course, that's associated with high environmental engagement and efficacy, but that one's actually linked in the research to high levels of the negative feelings, including the anxious and depressive feelings, and that's, we surmise that that's because the scale of the problem is huge and that one person's individual actions can't ever solve climate change, and that there is a risk when, you know, if you're just you know, beating away in your own, you know, life, trying to reduce your own carbon footprint and watching, you know, the rest of the world not taking action that's commensurate with the size of the problem, that can lead to feelings of being overwhelmed and those negative feelings of, you know, despair. So that's where the importance of that meaning-focused coping strategies is really important, being able to maintain some hope and optimism by, you know, looking out and noticing all the other people around the world who are also taking this very seriously and doing something about it, and being able to see that...
something with this, because one of the things that, you know, I think one sees it a lot in the United States is... there is like a pessimism, a cynicism, and a kind of despair that some people visit occasionally and some people visit it more than occasionally, because there are a lot of people who, having, you know, observed the takeover of our government and their inability to act in appropriate ways on behalf of, you know, human beings and other living beings on this earth. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of people who've concluded that no change is possible, and they're, you know, and they've withdrawn from activity. They're personally despairing about it, or they'll, you know, pick some, there is another group, which is, I think, what you're saying, the problem solving. They'll pick one thing and, you know, kind of hold to the belief of, this is what one person can do, and this is what I can do, and, you know, and the rest of it, you know, is more, you know, I can't take that on, and that's more than what people can do. So, like, what I think those are two sides of a certain kind of systemic sense of inefficacy and disempowerment that people understandably experience in relation to these big systems that are very entrenched and, you know, and kind of entangled with the sources of the problem, the industries creating the problem. You know, so I don't know if you've, you know, I see people kind of cycling through those areas or even getting stuck there as a kind of coping mechanism. I don't, you know, there are a lot of Americans, I think, who are kind of stuck in that box, maybe less so children because they don't have a long history of, you know, watching the American government, you know, go awry. But, you know, I'm personally observing a lot of people in, you know, we can't do anything space. And some people in, we can only do these little incremental things space. And, you know, I feel good about doing that, even though, so it kind of almost sounds like one group has arrived into the state of depression and the other group is kind of heading there while kind of staving it off through these incremental solutions. Would that be, you know, is that an accurate application of what we've been talking about?
Look, I think you are describing the risks and the places that people can end up when, you know, they're noticing that, you know, global efforts or national efforts to actually address this existential threat are failing. And I guess there's another way in which people can react as well, which is to become a bit hedonistic, or they can become angry. And so you're describing, you know, some can become resigned and helpless and hopeless and passive. Some can become, you know, fixated on, you know, incremental things that become a little bit tokenistic to sort of make themselves feel as if they are still doing something, even though, you know, it's not fixing everything. And, you know, that's probably a more adaptive coping strategy. And then we know that there are people who then just go, oh, well, I'll just, you know, I'll live it up then. A smaller group of people, you know, who turn to that sort of hedonistic perspective. But let's just have a talk for a little bit. Let's unpack that a little bit more, because around, you know, the literature that has been written on hope and optimism and its, you know, essential value, and also how this has an impact on young people as well. So there's been a number of researchers that have looked at different, you know, the importance of hope in addressing these sorts of, you know, large issues. And some of the terms that they use to describe the type of hope that's most essential in these times are a grounded hope or an authentic hope. And grounded hope or authentic hope is the hope that a person cultivates when they are realistically looking at the scale of the problem, and they are realistically aware that maybe the efforts that we make are going to be too little or too late, but they're going to keep fighting for what they know is the right response, even though the chances of it succeeding are perhaps seeming very small at the moment, simply because they know that it's the right thing to do, and there's nothing, there's, you know, nothing else that makes as much sense as continuing to engage with the problem and to try to, you know, change the course of history. So that's what grounded or authentic hope is. And that's the same as what Maria Ajala is talking about, is meaning-focused coping. It's looking at the problem and seeing the problem and feeling the enormity of the problem, but finding some hopeful perspective within that that keeps you engaged and doing something about it, even though you're not entirely sure that the things that you do are actually going to make a difference. And the reason why that's so important is twofold. One is because it's much easier to get out of bed each morning if you feel hopeful and optimistic. So to be hopeful and optimistic is an incredibly energizing and important way of maintaining our personal well-being. When we lose hope and we have no hope or optimism at all anymore, that's when we're really at risk of getting depressed. And that's not only a miserable place to be, but it's a dangerous place to be, and it has a negative effect on, you know, our families and our work life and, you know, everything that we do. So that's the first reason. And the second reason why it's so important to be able to help people to cultivate that perspective of authentic hope, even though things look really bad, is because we have no option but to solve the climate crisis. We simply cannot not do it. You know, we're all connected to, you know, children and young people, whether we have our own children or not. We all can see the, you know, the value of the diverse ecosystems that are around us and these amazing creatures who, you know, we are subjecting to so much. And so we have no choice but to continue to do everything that we can to address the climate crisis and restore a safe climate. And we will do it because humans have always done this. We have always been able to, you know, face dreadful threats and you know, over a long period of time, get to the other side of them. And so that's another example of meaning-focused coping. It's teaching yourself to have a perspective that looks at other enormous struggles at other times in history. Like, I'm sure that when people were in the middle of, you know, the apartheid struggle, you know, decades before it actually was resolved in Africa, that they were feeling this utter despair and at times and grief and, you know, fear about the enormity of that problem. And then the system ended and fell. And the same with, you know, freeing the slaves and, you know, giving women the vote and dealing with the HIV crisis and, you know, ending the First World War and the Second World War. You know, when people have been in the middle of a terribly frightening, same with the nuclear threat. I mean, we still do have this nuclear threat, but that was something that a lot of the adults today were growing up with in the 80s, was this terrible threat when, you know, the doomsday clock was, you know, not far off midnight, and there were a lot of fears then about this enormous existential threat to, you know, civilization all around the world. So that's just a little rant on an example of meaning-focused coping, where you seek hard to find the energy and the optimism and the hope, even though rationally you're not quite sure that it's there at the moment, simply because there's nothing else to do, and simply because it's our responsibility as you know, citizens of the world, to do that on behalf of everybody else. Anyway, I've also wanted to relate that.
I've been trying to promote activism and advocacy for a number of years. I do that in my reporting. And one of the cliches at this point, which I always tell people, but it's actually the truth, is that the company of other people who are active, engaged, and in advocacy is actually the best company in the world. And that's another thing. You know, I think we've been taught in these over-civilized Western societies, you know, that it's each man and each woman for his or herself, and, you know, it's our family unit, we'll protect and defend them against, you know, through financial success, against any threat in the outer world. We haven't been really acculturated to see ourselves in community, engaged, working together on a problem, you know, coming together with other people, using mutual energy. It's, you know, we're not really in all cases trained that way, beyond, you know, like making money and doing it for economic reasons of success or whatever. So, you know, when you kind of find yourself or find your way to a community of people who are mission-driven about something so important, you know, it's a whole different social and community experience than each one on his own being financially successful or creative or even enlightened, you know, when you're kind of doing it in a team. And you know, and not just a competitive sport, your team versus my team, your political group versus my political group or whatever, but, you know, you're really doing it on behalf of the whole. And so one gets energy from that. And as an older person doing it, I can both support the younger people, and I also get a lot of energy from their enthusiasm and their vibrancy and, you know, the extent to which it matters to them. And in more tribal-oriented societies, you know, this is kind of what people have always done. I mean, I've even heard people who, you know, say something like, oh, well, one shouldn't participate in this kind of a struggle because, you know, if you have anger, you have negative emotions while you're doing this, then, you know, while you're pointing to, you know, a societal problem or an act of harm that the society is doing, that by even focusing on it somehow, there's some people who believe that you actually magnify it, and that, you know, the best thing to do is to just keep your own energy in a good space and, you know, and try to detach from these unpleasant things, or somehow you're abetting them. I mean, what would be your perspective on that as a psychologist? Because I do hear those, you know, those kinds of things from people.
Yeah, well, that's a form of emotion-focused coping. That's a form of, you know, trying to soothe your own feelings by, you know, withdrawing a bit and just using your own energies and not participating. But I think the point that you made before about the enormous value and comfort that comes from being in a group of people who share, you know, a similar concern and vigor around trying to leave the world in a better place is enormously important. So part of the work that Anne Sanson and Judith Van Horn, who were my psychologist colleagues who we wrote these articles with, has been to develop a couple of brochures for parents around raising children for a climate-altered world. And in this, we look at the different skills and attributes that children really need to learn to be able to thrive. So parents who are concerned about climate change are thinking, oh, you know, A, what can I do to, you know, make a safer world for my children? But B, how do I bring my children up to best equip them to be able to cope with this climate-altered world that will be inevitable, even if, you know, we were to all of a sudden, you know, reduce emissions and create a more stable climate? And so one of them is, there's four categories of skills and attributes, and one of them is exactly what you were talking about, which is social engagement, you know, helping the children to, you know, be together in, you know, work together with other people. And with social engagement, we go even further. We know from the research that's been done by developmental psychologists, and Anne Sanson, one of our authors, has done a lot of this research herself, into positive development in young people. One of the elements of that is the value of them being socially engaged in their communities. And so that's that very thing that you're talking about, finding ways of helping young people and adults, because this applies to adults as well, to have this feeling of being involved in their communities by volunteering, by being a part of, you know, tree planting groups and river cleanup groups, and encouraging, you know, people to make groups if they can't find a group, and to do things like that. So, look, I'll give you I'll come back to that. And then the other three categories of skills and attributes that, you know, we write about as being important for children to learn is interpersonal skills. So that's, you know, how they relate to people. And so that's instilling in them values of cooperation and sharing and negotiation and interdependency, and seeing that as valuable rather than it being just, you know, looking after yourself. And those are critical in a climate-altered world when we know that vulnerable people are going to be even more vulnerable as society becomes harsher because of, you know, our reaching resource limits and things like that. And so helping children to look for the best in other people, and explaining to children the importance of being a giver, somebody who looks after other people and cares for other people and shares with other people. And those sorts of things are important skills. And then there are the individual skills and capacities of, you know, being able to regulate your emotions and be able to manage your own feelings in a way that makes you feel safe. So those are individual level skills. And the fourth one is what we're seeing young people doing all around the world, and that's civic engagement. So helping children to become global citizens and helping them to feel that they have some capacity to make change. So at the same time as that's been happening in America with your, you know, this Green New Deal and the climate, you know, these young people declaring wanting the government to declare a climate emergency, we've also been finding in Australia, inspired by the Swedish teenager Greta Thunberg, that children have started going on strike from school here. So my daughter was actually one of the children in her community who started that. She read an article about Greta and then talked to a couple of her friends, and they started going on strike, sitting outside, leaving school, sitting outside the front of local politicians' offices and gradually getting meetings with politicians to sit down at the table and discuss their concerns with them. And we've got a federal election coming up, so we've got a slightly more enormously more dynamic political space that the children are working in at the moment, where, you know, it's likely that there might be a change of government. So there's two political parties for them to be advocating with, and they're trying very hard to make climate change be an election issue, because we haven't had an election that's been won on climate change issues or fought on climate change issues for number of years. They often try to avoid it at this time of, you know, our political cycle. And so that's a really good example, just like with your young people in America, of children becoming global citizens, of these children getting out there and doing what they can with the power that they have been able to extract, i.e. walking out of school, because nobody likes kids to walk out of school and go on strike, and participate in this non-violent sort of direct action. And also, what I also love about what your young people are doing and our young people are doing here, and kids, is that it is in the spirit of that non-violent civil disobedience movement, which is, you know, which is the tool that has been used to create all of the, you know, meaningful system changes around the world, you know, in a hugely successful way. And so that the young people, and it's very appropriate that those be the techniques that they're using, because they're idealistic and they're moralistic, and they're, you know, developing their views of, you know, how it is to be a person in the world, and ideas of right and wrong. And these are their tools that they're using, and it's beautiful to see. And I think it's really inspiring for all the adults as well, like you were saying, you know, that you've been feeling and that the people around you feel about the young people. And they've got cut through, because what they're saying is utterly true. This is their world that they've not made decisions about yet, that is going to be altered in such a way that's going to dramatically impact on their physical and mental health for the length of their life, and that's not right.
That's really true. It isn't right. You know, it's interesting that as we're coming down to the last 5 minutes of the program here, that we're coming to this point, because when I began with this work, you know, which is a number of years back, one of the things that we always said, that's kind of the eternal question when asking questions about people who, you know, are pursuing a greed-driven or profit agenda, disconnected from the fate of the earth and the fate of their own descendants, their own children and grandchildren. You know, the classic question is, you know, don't they care about their grandchildren? And I remember hearing a well-known speaker who's, like, you know, teaching at a conference or something about this, who had worked with a lot of corporate leaders, and he said, you know, get over it. They don't care about their grandchildren. And, you know, I think in a way we have been taught, in the same way that we make people of different races or people in poverty or people in other parts of the world who are suffering the ill effects of what we do invisible, that what in this country they kind of call erasure has also extended, you know, to our own descendants with the misbegotten notion that if we can just provide for them, they will, you know, be in some separate category from everyone else. And that, and, you know, climate change makes that position completely untenable. So it's really a,
yes,
the world turning when the children themselves, you know, are, as they rightly have a right to do, making themselves present. You know, calling the older generation into account. And I know some people are like, well, how come they're so rude as to talk to an older person? It's because we haven't really been including them in our values, in our, you know, activities. And, you know, so I think it's actually a beautiful, beautiful thing. So I just want to thank you. This has been such a fantastic conversation. We've been talking with Dr. Susie Burke, about the mental health and impacts and of on children of climate change around the world, and the various ways that we can understand that, we can support what they're doing, and we all can really find coping in a way that really helps solve the problem and creates community and solidarity so that we can really solve this challenge and constructively. You know, thank you so much, Dr. Burke, for joining us today on Connect the Dots.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much for inviting me. It is my favorite topic, so it was a delight to spend this time talking with you on your program.
Well, we need to really think and hear and validate this more. So, you know, we'll keep the conversation going somehow or other. Thank you for your fine work. I think it's just so, so important in helping people gain understanding. And thank you, listeners, for being with us on this edition of Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. For the coming week, be well, stand tall, marching forward with all our relations.
Somewhere.